52 years ago, I drove down the road outside to go to my very first job as a teenager in the Don Valley Parkway. I haven't been along the road since, so it's a great pleasure to be back in Toronto. Pour ceux qui parlent français, bienvenue. This is a country of two languages, I understand, both of which I love. I'm almost tempted to give you a lecture responding to the questions, because this methodology I have encountered before, and a very simple system is they put the questions up, they don't tell me what they are, and then I interact with them immediately afterwards. I may interact with some of them. It was very interesting to see that the problem of evil and pain was number one. It is number one. 4 out of 5 universities of which I have spoken recently in North America ask to speak on that particular topic. But it's not our topic tonight. And Andy has really set me up extremely well by his analysis of the question as to whether belief in God or Christianity is mad, bad, or dangerous. And I want to go back where he started, because what we are dealing with is the pressure from the new atheism, although I must tell you that we now have the new atheists. And the new atheists are like the old atheists. They have the view that religion, some of it's quite good. Let's take the best of it, let's not knock it too much, but let's just leave God out of it and everybody will be happy. But whether it's the new atheists or the old new atheists or the original atheists, there is enormous pressure in our culture today to not do God in public. The privatization of faith in God is the pressure in most Western societies. And the pressure comes often from very vocal people who are scientifically trained and use quite deliberately the full clout and prestige of science to communicate the idea that belief in God is psychologically dangerous and in the end completely irrelevant in any case. For instance, Steven Weinberg won the Nobel Prize for Physics and said some time ago that the world needs to wake up from the long nightmare of religion. Anything we scientists can do to weaken the hold of religion should be done, and may in fact be our greatest contribution to civilization. And you notice that sinister, rather totalitarian suggestion, anything we can do. There's no apparent limitation, such is the danger of religion. Now Richard Dawkins, in his book The God Delusion, defines delusion for us as a persistent false belief held in the face of strong contrary evidence with psychiatric overtones. And he very wisely leaves those overtones aside. And I'm going to suggest rather provocatively this evening that according to that definition, atheism is a delusion. It's a persistent false belief held in the face of very strong contrary evidence. Now when people make claims like this, you need to analyze the kind of framework in which they're made. Delusion is a psychiatric term. And neither Richard Dawkins nor I is a psychiatrist. And the sensible thing to do in that event is to consult the psychiatrists. One of the problems in the contemporary God and science debate is that people sometimes do not recognize when they're moving outside the domain of their own expertise, as I'm doing right now. I'm a pure mathematician, so I need to be very sensitive to the fact when I step outside my own field to check with the best evidence in the field that I'm investigating to make sure that I've got it as right as I can. When you go to real psychiatrists, you find that Dawkins' claim is completely false. Let's take Andrew Sims, the past president of the Royal Society of Psychiatrists in the United Kingdom. He says the advantageous effect of religious belief and spirituality is one of the best kept secrets in psychiatry and medicine generally. If the findings of the huge volume of research on this topic had gone in the opposite direction, and it had been found that religion damages your mental health, it would have been front page news in every newspaper in the land. The evidence, if you want to be a scientist, and you're claiming to investigate it scientifically, flows in exactly the opposite direction. Listen to his citation of a major meta-analysis, that is a study of studies in epidemiology in the American Journal of Public Health. The majority of studies showed that religious involvement is correlated with well-being, happiness, life satisfaction, hope, optimism, purpose, meaning in life, higher self-esteem, better adaptation to bereavement, greater social support, less loneliness, lower rates of depression, faster rates of recovery from depression, and so on and so forth. That's what the evidence shows. Dawkins is merely expressing a prejudice and not backing it up with any evidence at all. Now, Andy mentioned Sigmund Freud, and the Freudian argument, as he pointed out, and it's immensely important to realize it, boomerangs on itself and backfires. And one of the best exponents of this is Germany's leading psychiatrist, whom I had the pleasure to listen to just a few days ago in Hamburg, where I was lecturing. His name is Manfred Lutz, and he's written a book called Eine kleine Geschichte des Größten, which being translated means a brief history of the Great One. And his argument is very witty. I'm not sure if the book's in English yet. I hope it will be in English, because it's well worth reading. It's a witty demolition of this argument, and the bottom line goes like this. If there is no God, the Freudian argument that religion in general, and Christianity in particular, is a projection of our desires for a father figure, works brilliantly if there is no God. Of course, he says, if there is a God, the argument works beautifully in the other direction, that atheism is a wish fulfillment, a projection of our deep desire never to have anything to do with God. And one of the Polish Nobel Prize winners, Czesław Miłosz, made the point that atheism is the great opiate of the people. It's that deep desire never to have to face God who will assess our lives and face us with the evils that we've done. But then Lutz says this, the question whether there is a God or not is not addressed either by Freud, Jung, or Frankl. You have to go elsewhere for evidence. So in a sense, those Freudian arguments neutralize themselves. And if you'll forgive a personal reference, it was rather nice when Stephen Hawking, being interviewed, said about religion it was a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. And one of our national newspapers kindly asked me for a comment, so I said I'll happily do that. Atheism is a fairy story for people afraid of the light. Now, your clapping shows you haven't followed my argument, because these statements prove nothing in either direction. We have to look for evidence. So that is the first thing we need to look at. The next thing is the idea that religion is a pernicious delusion. That, of course, is a very serious accusation that is often made against us. And it's made against me in particular, because I come from Northern Ireland. I'm not only Irish, I'm not only an Ulster, I'm an Ulster Scot, that is, so I have the problems of both nations built into me automatically, which I resolved by marrying an English wife. So, we do need to face this question, and I get it all the time. historically, Northern Ireland has a reputation for sectarianism and violence, and people say, how can you retain any sense of belief in God with that as a background? And so I tell them something that's been very important in my life. Firstly, that my parents were very unusual people. They were Christian without being sectarian, which meant they employed equally in their small business across the Protestant-Catholic divide, for which they were bombed, and in which my brother nearly lost his life. So terrorism of that kind has come very near to home. So when I am asked to respond to this, I say first of all that when I look at the situation in my own country, I'm utterly ashamed of it. Utterly ashamed of it. Ashamed, that is, that the name of Christ was ever associated with a bomb or an AK-47. But the important thing is to explain why I'm ashamed of it. And I'm ashamed of it because, of course, Jesus himself repudiated the use of force and violence to defend either himself or his message. Now here's the irony of the situation. Christopher Hitchens, when I debated him in Edinburgh at the festival, he started off a 15-minute raging, really, at the evils of religion. And afterwards I pointed out to him exactly what Andy said a few moments ago, that actually Jesus was on his side. I said, Christopher, I can see you've never really read the Gospels. He said, how do you know? Well, I said, if you'd read them and understood what Jesus claims, you'd be on his side, not fighting against him. I agree with your critique of religion entirely. That is the unacceptable face of religion. But it is not Christianity. If we want to understand what Christianity is, we go and see what position Christ took. Now, here's a second irony, and it's a very important one. Many of our friends that say that religion is responsible for all the evils in the world, other religions must of course answer for themselves in this, I speak as a Christian here, have failed to realize that Christ was put on trial for being a terrorist. He was accused to the Romans of fomenting political terrorism and violence from Jerusalem to Galilee. So in other words, he was accused of the same thing that the new atheists accused Christianity of. And he was declared innocent of the charge by the Roman authorities. I used to wonder why there's so much in the New Testament, not only about the crucifixion and the resurrection of Christ, but about the trial of Christ. I think I understand. Because the historical detail now becomes enormously important. What does Christianity say about violence? And Pilate, of course, had a report of the soldier who witnessed the arrest and witnessed the very curious incident of the sword in the night time. Do you remember that story? Where Peter, not being very clever or wise, took a sword and took a slash at the high priest's servant and cut his ear off. Jesus put the ear back on, and I believe that as a scientist, but that's another story. But I'm an Irish storyteller as well, and you'd be as blind as a bat if you couldn't see that this is preaching a powerful message. If you take physical weapons to defend Christ or his message, you will cut the ears off people in a big way. And I'm in the ear repair business, and you ought to be too if you're a Christian. So many of my friends and acquaintances have had the ears cut off. They're not remotely interested in Christianity because they've had a rotten experience in this direction, leading and perhaps including violence. So it's most important to see why Christ was declared free of this charge. Pilate asked him straight, are you a king? Are you a political threat to me? And he said, my kingdom is not of this world. Otherwise, my servants would have been fighting. He explained exactly what he meant. To this end, I was born. And to this end, I came into the world that I should bear witness to the truth. Upon which Pilate said, what is truth? And went out and declared him innocent because he could see. as clearly as I hope you can see, that the one thing you cannot do with violence is to impose truth. It cannot be done, especially if the truth is about forgiveness, peace with God, salvation, and eternal life. It just cannot be done. But it's very important that we are aware of the history, so that when this objection comes up, we can meet it on its own ground. Now, the accusations in both the first lecture and now in the second are all negative, but they miss a couple of major issues out. The first thing is the positive contribution of Christianity to civilization. What about that? It is enormous. Absolutely enormous. The motto of my University of Oxford is Dominus Illuminatio Mea. The Lord is my light. Why is that? Because it was a religious, a Christian institution. Far from Christians being anti-scientific, they were at the heart of the intellectual ferment for centuries. We forget that. And indeed, although Richard Dawkins doesn't appear to see it, cleverer atheists than he do, Jürgen Habermas is perhaps one of the most distinguished atheists in the world, in Germany. And he warns his fellow atheists against eliminating religion because, I quote, they will be removing a very important source of meaning for many people. And then he says this in another context. Universal egalitarianism, from which sprang the ideals of freedom and a collective life and solidarity, the individual morality of conscience, human rights and democracy, is the direct legacy of the Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love. This legacy, substantially unchanged, has been the object of continual critical appropriation and reinterpretation. To this day, there is no alternative to it. And in light of the current challenges, we continue to draw on the substance of this heritage. Everything else, this is an atheist writing, everything else is just idle postmodern talk. Behind the European Declaration of Human Rights lies Christianity. Behind universities, hospices, hospitals lies Christianity. Behind the abolition of slavery lies Christianity. It is a delusion that Christianity has done no good whatsoever in history. It's a persistent false belief held in the teeth of powerful countervailing evidence. But now there's a third prong in this discussion. The first thing is the accusation that Christianity is bad. The next is avoiding investigating what good Christianity has done. But the next thing is avoiding completely the evil that atheism has perpetuated. Andy put up on the screen John Lennon's song Imagine. Well, I'm not John Lennon, I'm John Lennox. And I've written a song. It's called Imagine. I'm not going to sing it, ladies and gentlemen. Imagine a world without Stalin, Pol Pot, or Mao. What about that? I don't read about that in Richard Dawkins' book. You see, they've made several serious intellectual mistakes. First of all, they got it wrong for blaming Christianity and violence. Secondly, they failed to analyze the good that Christianity has done. And third, they've airbrushed out the 20th century history of atheism. And that is very sad indeed. John Gray, who is an atheist and has already been quoted, is very honest. And he says, the totalitarian regimes of the last century embodied some of the Enlightenment's boldest dreams. Some of their worst crimes were done in the service of progressive ideals, while even regimes that viewed themselves as enemies of Enlightenment values attempted a project of transforming humanity by using the powers of science whose origin are in Enlightenment thinking. And the disastrous attempt at social engineering that was Stalinism. 100 million people perished. And when Solzhenitsyn was asked to sum up why that happened, he said, The short answer is we have forgotten God. Now, I've been in Russia many times. I speak the language and I've been able to interact with many people in the academies of science. And how often I was told in the early 90s by leading intellectuals, we thought that we could get rid of God and retain a value for human beings, and we found we couldn't. That's analysis, isn't it? It's an ethical analysis, and I mustn't stray in there because that's a huge topic in its own right, but it is an immensely important one. So I'm suggesting to you that atheism at this level, and Dawkins' version of it surely, is a delusion, a persistent false belief held in the face of strong countervailing evidence. But I was asked to say a little bit about the scientific side of all of this, because after all, the new atheists, so-called, tend to use science to propagate their message. Now, I'm going to talk about a further series of delusions. It seems to me that the whole topic and debate has run into an intellectual fog, and I hope that I may be rather briefly able to clear up some elements of that fog. The first one is that the new atheists, deliberately, as far as I can see, have spread around a completely false notion of faith. What is faith? Now, it's interesting that we, these days, I'm sometimes asked to give lectures on science and faith. And I say to people, do you want me to mention God? And they said, of course. Well, I said, I don't say anything about God in the title. Well, they said, there's the word faith. But I said, that's a multivalent word. It's a shorthand for religion. But its normal meaning is trust. And I can talk to you about faith and science without mentioning God at all, because science involves faith at the deepest levels. So the formulation, science and faith, is an atheistic one. It isn't a Christian one. The thing that corresponds to science, if you want to balance them, is theology. And I prefer to speak of God and science, but never faith. Because what has happened is this, that the redefinition of faith, it's almost comical, but it's very serious. It's very serious because it is so pernicious. Faith, for many people now, is, firstly, a religious term. And secondly, it means believing when there's no evidence. So, as a result of that, you get statements like, atheists do not have faith, said Dawkins. Or, Christopher Hitchens, going a step further into absurdity, our beliefs are not a belief, our faith is not a faith. And I had an amazing example of this when I debated Peter Singer, who's the world's most eminent professor of bioethics, because I told the audience, as I tell most audiences, about my parents and my background. So he got up and said, well, there you are. He said, you know, that's my biggest objection against religion. People remain in the faith in which they grow up. And he didn't quite say you're a prime example, but it was obvious what he meant. So I thought, I'm going to have some fun with this. And I did, because sure enough, I got the chance to speak. And I said, Peter, I've told the audience about my parents. Will you tell them about yours? He said, what do you mean? I said, were they atheists? He said, they were. Oh, I said, so you've remained in the faith in which you were brought up. Oh, but he said, it isn't a faith. Oh, Peter, I said, I thought you believed it. Now, this is one of the world's leading philosophers, ladies and gentlemen. And I was staggered, the audience were staggered, and cyberspace went wild. He didn't realize that his atheism is a belief system. Now, that's serious. You see, this is what we're up against. We're up against a totally biased situation where atheism has got itself so embedded as the default position that there's no element of belief in it, which is nonsense, of course. Why? Because they've redefined faith to be what we normally call blind faith. That is dangerous, of course, believing where there's no evidence. So, sadly, when they meet people like me, Lennox is a man of faith. That's an insult. It's the biggest insult they could make. Because it means Lennox believes where there's no evidence, there's no point in discussing it with him. And that is the most brilliantly devious intellectual cop-out I've ever met. All of us in this room, whether we believe in God or not, have a belief system. And Dawkins once made the point, well, they make it all the time, they don't seem to be able to give it up, that atheism just means there is no God. It's not a belief system. Just like they accuse me of being an atheist prospector, and they start with Artemis and go right through the alphabet to Zeus and Wotan. I'm an atheist with respect to all of those gods. We just go one God further. You've probably heard that silly argument. Which shows they haven't a clue about the ancient Near Eastern gods to start with. Because the difference between them, of course, and the God of the Bible is utterly profound. The ancient gods were descended from the heavens and the earth. They were part of the physical substratum of the world. The God of the Bible created the heavens and the earth. He wasn't derived from it. But the important point is just to observe. I said, well, Richard, it's very interesting to note you have not written a 400-page book on Awotanism or Azusism, but you have written a 400-page book on atheism, because, of course, the flip side, you're technically right, atheism simply means no God, but it entails the positive philosophy of naturalism, and that's what you're developing in your book. It's a huge belief system. And of course he belies himself when he says a naturalist believes, and then he goes through the thing. But we need to get back, ladies and gentlemen, to a proper understanding of faith, and stop, if I might suggest, using it as a shorthand for religion, because it confuses people. Faith is an ordinary word in English, derived from the Latin fides, fidelity, trust. And whenever anybody says in an equivalent way, I trust something, I believe in something, I'm committed to something, the first question you logically can ask is, on what basis? Faith demands to be questioned in that sense. On what basis do you trust him? And there's not a man or woman in the Western world that doesn't understand what evidence-based faith is after the financial crisis. Do you remember that? The faith in the markets evaporated and they froze. Because there was no base for confidence. And it could only be got back, and we all understand this, by confidence suddenly creeping back and people trusting. And then the system began slowly to unfreeze, costing billions to the general public. We all understand what evidence-based faith is. Now, the crucial thing we need to face is this. Other faiths must answer for themselves, other religions. Is Christianity evidence-based or not? And here the philosophers pile in with the greatest of banalities, I must say. One of our leading philosophers is A.C. Grayling. In his very first article, I think it was, in The New Scientist, he says, Jesus expects us to have blind faith. And I thought, this is going to be interesting. So I look up what he says, and sure enough, he quotes the famous story, which some of you will know, of doubting Thomas. And Thomas wasn't there when the other disciples saw the risen Christ. And so he asked and said, unless I see the marks in his hands and so on, I will not believe. And then the story relates how that Jesus appeared, and Thomas, we're not told, he actually touched the Lord. When he saw him, he fell down and bowed before him and said, my Lord and my God. And Jesus then said this, Thomas, because you've seen, you've believed. Happy are those who have not seen and yet believed. There you are, says Grayling. Jesus says he believed without evidence. Can the man not read? It says, because you have seen. Blessed are those that have not seen. Now let me put it to you. There's not a single person in this room that's seen Jesus in the way Thomas did. So we've got no evidence. Well, that's absolute nonsense. Seeing is only one kind of evidence. And the Lord is making a precise point. And the irony is that Grayling not only couldn't understand the plain English in front of him, he didn't read the next statement. Because the next statement says, many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. Here's the evidence upon which faith is based. But he didn't read that. And this man claims to be a philosopher. The sad thing, ladies and gentlemen, as I get older, and you see I'm very old, I take, and Andy takes, the writings of these people seriously. They won't even do us the dignity of taking our evidence seriously. And the banality of that kind of analysis, if it occurred in any other discipline, would simply wipe them out of any pretension to be intellectuals. It's an enormous battle if people can get away with that kind of thing. So, the take-home message here is this, that Christianity is evidence-based. We've reasons for believing Jesus is the Son of God. I wouldn't stand here for a microsecond if I didn't think we got reasons. And those reasons are, of course, at many levels. Some of them are arguments. Some of them are experiences. The biggest reason, of course, any of us have, like Saul on the road to Damascus, was his living experience of God. So the word reason is not simply to be confined to the end product of a logical argument. Christianity is an evidence-based faith. And the new atheists are deluded about the nature of faith. But there's more. There's a flip side to all of this. What about the faith of atheists? What about that faith? And that bears a little analysis. I mentioned it, now let me explain it a bit. You see, science cannot do without trust, faith, and belief. Indeed, physicist Paul Davis, who's not a theist, although he really ought to be on the basis of what he writes, he says the right scientific attitude is essentially theological. Science can proceed only if the scientist adopts an essentially theological worldview. Even the most atheistic scientist, and I'm quoting, accepts as an act of faith the existence of a law-like order in nature that is at least in part comprehensible to us. Albert Einstein famously said, science can only be created by those who are thoroughly imbued with the aspiration towards truth and understanding. This source of feeling, however, springs from religion. To this there also belongs the faith in the possibility that the regulations valid for the world of existence are rational. That is comprehensible to reason. I, said Einstein, cannot imagine a scientist without that profound faith. This is Einstein. He was relatively bright, wasn't he? He could see what a lot of much more superficial people couldn't see. That the whole scientific endeavor depends on you believing to start with that science can be done. It depends on you believing to start with that the universe is mathematically intelligible. Science doesn't explain that to you. My teacher of quantum physics at Cambridge, Sir John Polkinghorne, was constantly reminding people that physics is powerless to explain its own faith in the rational intelligibility of nature, for the very simple reason that unless you believe that to start with, you'll never do any physics. And we need to grasp this. It's vastly important, because by redefining faith for the widespread population, they have deluded people into thinking that only atheists are free of this faith thing. Religious people are indoctrinated by it, poor fools. And yet, it's absolutely essential to the scientific endeavor. And actually, one of my main reasons as a scientist for not being an atheist is simply that science can be done. And I'm going to explain that a little bit more in a moment. So, well, let me put it this way. I am a fellow at an Oxford college, and we have dinners, and we have lots of nice chats, and so on. And sometimes when the conversation gets boring, which is rare, I ask questions. Indeed, I do it all the time. I love playing Socrates. He's one of my great intellectual heroes. So, conversation goes often like this, and I'm going to cut it very short. Tell me, I say to a scientific colleague, what do you do science with? Oh, they say, I've just been given $1 million. Now, no, I don't mean that. Not that machine, I mean this. Oh, they say, you mean my, and they're about to say mind, when they remember the current theories, and they say brain. Because, of course, there's no such thing as a mind as distinct from the brain, according to them. Well, I allow that, even though I don't believe it. If it were true, we'd never know it anyway, but let's come. So I do it with my brain. Oh, I say, that's very interesting. You do science with your brain. Tell me about the brain. Do you want the long story or the short story? You can just say, oh, I said, I want the short story. Okay, fine. The brain essentially is the end product of a mindless process that didn't foresee it. And I just look at them and I grin and I say, and you trust it. And you trust it. Do you know who first raised that issue? You might be surprised it was Charles Darwin. It's called Darwin's Doubt. He said, I often wonder, when I think of the human mind, how its thoughts could be of any value or at all trustworthy, if, as I believe, they are developed from the minds of lower animals. After all, would anyone trust, I'm still quoting Darwin, in the convictions of a monkey's mind, if there are any convictions in such a mind? What I'm going to suggest to you is, in the technical sense, atheism is a delusion at this level. It's not science and God that conflict. It's science and atheism that conflict. I want you to try and follow the logic of this, because this is, I believe, where some of the most powerful arguments today lie. Let me repeat that. The conflict is not between science and God. That, by the way, ought to be completely obvious to anybody. Take the Nobel Prize for Physics. Last year won by Peter Higgs, a Scotsman, an atheist. A few years ago won by Bill Phillips, an American Christian. Their physics doesn't divide them. They both won the Nobel Prize. What does divide them is their worldview. One's an atheist, the other a theist. And I want to suggest to you that the conflict here is not between science and faith in God. It's between two worldviews, atheism and, in my case, Christian theism. They are diametrically opposed. But the important thing to notice is that there are brilliant intellectuals on both sides. So let's not run away with the idea that science and faith in God are fundamentally at odds. That cannot be the case. The other reason for believing it cannot be the case is, to make a long story short, we owe modern science to Christianity directly. All the early pioneers, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Clark Maxwell and so on, were all Christian. And as people reflect on that, C.S. Lewis put it best of all. Men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. That's why I'm not remotely embarrassed to be a Christian and a scientist, because arguably Christianity gave me my subject. We forget history. History is one of the most important disciplines. I wish I'd been taught it better at school. I've come to love it as an adult. It is so important in this debate. Because that's where we started. And I will try to explain how we got into the mess we've got into in a moment. But let me carry on with this brain You see, that doubt persists. I'm going to quote atheist John Gray again. Modern humanism is the faith that through science humankind can know the truth and so be free. But this is an atheist saying it, not me. If Darwin's theory of natural selection is true, this is impossible. The human mind serves evolutionary success and not truth. And again, John Polkinghorne refers to Francis Crick's very odd statement, which has become very famous. You, your joys and sorrows, your memories and ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. And he says that view is suicidal because if it's true, we can never know it, because it relegates our experiences of beauty, obligation, religious encounter, and rationality to the epiphenomenal scrap heap. It destroys rationality. Thought is replaced by electrochemical neural events. The very assertions of such people are nothing but blips in the neural network of his brain. Quite frankly, that cannot be right, and none of us believes it to be so. Now, this is now being taken up. C.S. Lewis saw this argument in the 1940s. It wasn't taken sufficient account of. But it has been revived by a famous American philosopher who's a Christian called Alvin Plantinga. And what he says is, if Dawkins is right that we are the product of mindless, unguided natural processes, then he has given us strong reason to doubt the reliability of human cognitive faculties, and therefore inevitably to doubt the validity of any belief that they produce, including Dawkins' own science and his atheism. But what is astonishingly interesting is in the last couple of years, a brilliant American philosopher, Thomas Nagel, who's an atheist, and he's a strong atheist, he doesn't want there to be a God, he's written so. But he's written a book with one of the most provocative titles I've ever seen, Mind and Cosmos, Why the Neo-Darwinian View of Nature is Almost Certainly False. What? An atheist writing that? And in it he says this, the issue is, can you reduce mind to brain, mind to matter? He's saying if the mental is not itself merely physical, it cannot be fully explained by physical science. Evolutionary naturalism implies that we shouldn't take any of our convictions seriously, including the scientific world picture on which evolutionary naturalism itself depends. Now, of course, there are high stakes here. Because what this is suggesting is not that naturalism, atheism, shoots itself in the foot. That's pretty painful, but you can survive it. It's suggesting that it shoots itself in the brain, and that's always fatal. So what I'm suggesting, let me repeat it again, is this. Atheism doesn't sit well with science. At all. It's a pernicious delusion held against the teeth of strong countervailing evidence because it doesn't account for our rationality. Now, Lewis's take on it is superb if you now read back into the history. He points out that the success of science, and we ought to be proud of it because we all use it, we saw the technology in operation there, is due to thinking about the world. But he said what we fail to do is think about thinking. And once you start to think about thinking, you realize that any theory you put up that renders thought invalid must be logically false and absurd. And that's exactly what's happening. Leading thinkers in the world are suggesting that the apparatus, whatever it is with which we think, has no rational base. And therefore they take away the base on which it claims to stand. Now, another delusion is a set of false beliefs about the nature of explanation. Let me focus this by pointing out that Isaac Newton believed in God, and Stephen Hawking, who held his chair at Cambridge until recently, does not. And they both used the law of gravity to support their claim. It's fascinating. When Isaac Newton discovered the law of gravity, he wrote the most brilliant book of the history of science, Principia Mathematica. And he expressed in it the hope that it would persuade a thinking person to believe in a deity. Stephen Hawking says, and I quote, from his book, The Grand Design, because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. So Newton, the law of gravity, is evidence for God. What a brilliant God that did it that way. For Hawking, the law of gravity is evidence against God. Now that is so interesting, it demands an explanation. How do we move from Newton to Hawking? And I think there are several reasons that I'm going to explain very rapidly. Number one is this, that Hawking has a false conception of God. He asks young people to choose between science and God. And I've analyzed that, and suddenly it dawned on me why he does that. It's not so much because his science is wrong, although we'll come to that in a minute, it's because his concept of God is wrong. Let me explain that to you. You see, all this talk about the ancient gods and thinking that the God of the Bible is one of them has led to another vast confusion. And it's this, that people like me believe in a so-called God of the gaps. I can't explain it, therefore God did it. That's what Hawking thinks Christians believe in. Now follow the logic if you can. You see, if you define God to be that which temporally explains what science has not yet explained, but will one day explain, as science advances, this space for God gets smaller. Well, if you believe in a God like that, of course you have to choose between God and science, because that's the way you've defined God. Now, do you follow that? It's slightly subtle. Let me repeat it. If you believe in a God of the gaps, you'll have to choose between science and God, because that's the way you've defined God. But the God of the Bible isn't a God of the gaps. Have you noticed, if you have a Bible, it does not begin with the words, "In the beginning God created the bits of the universe we don't understand." I mean, that's absurd. He created the whole show. That claim is of profound importance, because it's explaining to you that the God of the Bible is not a God of the gaps, but is the God of the whole show. So, of course, when Newton discovered his law of gravity, he thought, isn't that wonderful? I know something more about the genius of God. And it was what he understood about the universe that led him to praise God, not what he didn't understand. And, of course, that's the way our minds work anyway. The more you understand engineering, the more you'll understand the workings of a famous German car, the Rolls-Royce. Some of you are still awake, obviously, but very few. The more you understand a painting, the more, not the less, you'll understand of the genius of a Rubens or a Picasso. That's the way it works. The more we understand of the universe, the more we can worship the God that did it that way, because God is not simply to be found in the bits we can't yet understand. But if you define him like that, then you'll be saying to the public, you've got to choose between God and science. Now that's related to another problem that's very easy to understand. And that is the blatantly obvious fact that explanation comes at different levels. Why is the water boiling? Well, because the heat from the stove is being conducted through the copper base of the kettle. That's agitating the molecules of water. They're vibrating faster and faster, and steam is beginning to rise and so on. That's why it's boiling. What would you think if I said nonsense? That's not why it's boiling. It's boiling because I desperately want a cup of tea. Well, I'm glad you're laughing. Wouldn't you think the second explanation contradicted the first? Conflicted with the first? Well, of course not. Why is that? Because there are different kinds of explanation. I find children at school, 10 years old, can understand that perfectly. I meet many scientists who have to remain nameless who don't understand that. So if they've got a scientific explanation, that's it. You see, that's why Newton didn't react in the way he did. Because gravity doesn't compete with God, because it's a different kind of explanation. Now let me put it this way so that you can use it yourselves, because the simpler an argument is, the easier it is to use. Let's put it this way. God no more competes with science as an explanation for the universe than Henry Ford competes with the law of internal combustion as an explanation for the motor car. Have you got it? It's dead simple. We're used in life to different kinds of explanation, yet around us today there's a philosophy called scientism, which means science is the only way to truth. So once you've got a law or a mechanism, that's the explanation. It isn't, you know, not even within science itself. I loved the law of gravity. When I was able to deduce the elliptical orbits of the planets for it and prove it to students, I thought that was a terrific triumph. But you know, there was something they didn't teach me at school about the law of gravity. That it doesn't tell me what gravity is. Did you realize that? Nobody knows what gravity is. But you see, it's scientific explanation. What does it explain? The famous philosopher Wittgenstein got it exactly right when he said, the greatest delusion of modernism is that the laws of nature are explanations of the phenomena of nature. They are not their descriptions. Nobody knows what energy is. We've got laws governing energy, but we don't know what it is. The laws don't explain it. You see, even within science, it's limited. So that ought to make us humble and realize that there are hierarchies of explanation. And the existence of a mechanism or a law that does or describes something is not in itself an argument against the existence of an agent who designed it. That's just to confuse categories in philosophy, as we call them. Now, these are dead simple arguments, which is why I use them, because they're the crucially important ones. Because they take a lot of the sting and the heat straight out of the debate. God and science, where the science is true, of course, and the theology is true, are compatible descriptions from different perspectives of the very same universe. And you see, well, there's lots more than one could say. But since I mentioned it, let's have a bit of fun in the last couple of minutes before questions, analyzing the logic. Here's the central statement of Hawking's book. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. And when I first read that, I thought, come again. Because there is a law of gravity, because there is something, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. That's a flat contradiction. Oh, I thought, goodness me. Because there is a law of gravity, he doesn't say because gravity exists. But what would a law of gravity mean if there's no gravity? And that opens a window into a profound misunderstanding. Peter Atkins is a famous atheist and chemist whom I've debated. It's rather an interesting debate. You probably don't know about it, but you'll find it on YouTube under Dueling Professors. And I once asked Peter after another debate, I said, Peter, what do you think created the universe? And he said, mathematics. Now, I hadn't met him before, and I'm afraid I was caught off guard. I started to laugh. And he was quite upset, and he said, why are you laughing? Well, I said, Peter, I am a mathematician, and that's one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. He said, why? Well, I said, let me keep it simple for you. 1 + 1 = 2. Did that ever put $2 in your pocket? Oh, you're laughing, ladies and gentlemen. But there are many people around in this world who think that mathematics creates money. We call it creative accounting. You've heard of it, have you? Well, it's entered the scientific field. Now, Lewis, again, with his genius, I remember him well because I went to his last lectures in Cambridge, with his genius of seeing to the heart of things, he said you can do arithmetic from now to eternity, but if you don't first get the £1 and then get the second pound, you'll never get £2. Mathematics creates nothing. And that leads to another confusion. because there is a law of gravity. Hawking places the whole weight on the law of gravity, but laws never did anything. Newton's laws of motion never moved a billiard ball in the history of the universe. People were accused of that. This is another confusion, that the laws are causes and they're creative. They're neither. It's failure to understand basic elements of philosophy of science. Now, Stephen Hawking was a genius. I can remember him at Cambridge, a little bit older than me. Absolute genius. Light years ahead of me in his mathematical competence. But when it comes to philosophy, don't ask me what I think, but ask the philosophers what they think. He's writing nonsense. And it gets worse, because he says the universe will create itself. Now, if I say to you, X creates Y, what does that mean? Well, roughly speaking, for tonight, if you've got X, you'll get Y. So if I say to you, X creates X, what does that mean? Well, roughly speaking, it means if you've got X, you'll get X. And what does that mean? Well, that means that nonsense remains nonsense, even if high-powered scientists are writing it. What would you say if somebody wrote this for you? They are, of course, desperate, the cosmologists, and this is a huge topic, to get a universe from nothing. Their space-time theories have forced us to a singularity that there was a beginning to space-time. The Bible, by the way, has been saying that for centuries. We only caught up with it scientifically in the 1960s, which incidentally gives the lie to the idea that the Bible has no relevance to the physical universe. If people had taken the Bible more seriously than Aristotle, they might have looked for evidence for a beginning much earlier than they did. But now they've pushed it backwards, so there was nothing. So how do you get a universe from nothing? Well, you can't. And the attempts are hilarious. Listen to this one by leading astrophysicist Lawrence Krauss of University of Arizona. He writes about page 5 of his book, A Universe from Nothing. He writes, because something is physical, nothing must be physical, especially if you define it as the absence of something. What? I mean, that is sheer nonsense. And it fascinates me that people are so determined to run away from the obvious implications at every level that they turn to foolishness. There's something about that in the New Testament, isn't there? And it's very serious. Well, to sum up, to cut a long story short, ladies and gentlemen, there are two worldviews that collide. And when it comes to ultimate reality, the naturalistic worldview thinks that ultimate reality is either the multiverse or mass energy or something like that. And everything else is derivative, including life, consciousness, mind, and the idea of God, because there isn't a God, he's an illusion. The other worldview starts, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things came to be through him. And without him, nothing came to be that came to be. Do you see the difference? One starts with mass energy, the particles, and ends up with mind. The other starts with mind and ends up with mass energy. And every scientific instinct I've got parallels the insight of Scripture. Is God a delusion? No. I'm afraid, ladies and gentlemen, that if you define a delusion to be a persistent false belief held in the face of strong countervailing evidence, I would want to suggest to my many atheist friends that their atheism qualifies for that definition. Thank you very much.